So this afternoon, I wanted to take the opportunity with the holiday of Passover, Pesach, coming up. We know that one of our favorite pastimes, and perhaps in many of our homes, is to sing Dayenu, right? We can't get enough of Dayenu, which is, of course, a pun, because that's exactly what Dayenu means. Dayenu, Dayenu, right? It's enough, it's enough. My children like to joke, Dayenu, right? It's from dying, right? So they don't get it, but we know that in Hebrew, that's not what it means. It comes from this word that it's enough. And this is, of course, one of the most beloved songs of the Seder night. And I thought that since we spend so much time singing this song, but we don't necessarily always take the time to study this song, I thought it might be worthwhile to take a little bit of a look at this. And what I'd like to do is to analyze Dayenu as not just sort of a fun song, which it certainly is. In fact, I have a number of not friends, but the people that I know a little bit younger than I, who formed a student a cappella group at Yeshiva University called the Maccabees. Anyone familiar with the Maccabees? You've heard of them. So when I was the rabbi at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine at Yeshiva University's medical school, one of our students, Josh Jay, was a member of the Maccabees, and he's a minor celebrity. And the Maccabees actually have a fun riff on Dayenu, in which they walk into a Seder where all the children are bored and falling asleep and disinterested. And so they decide to have a little bit of fun with Dayenu. So they imagine all sorts of different scenarios. So they are dressed up very formally. They're out sipping coconut milk or something at the, you know, at the ocean's edge, and so on and so forth. So I had a lot of fun with this song. And I think in our homes, perhaps we have fun. We enjoy singing it. It's spirited. It's an upbeat tune. It's a lot of fun. And it's really one of the high points of the night of the Seder. But I wanted to do this afternoon is to study it a little bit and to think about what exactly it means. I took this from a version of Dayenu that I found online, and they included a fun fact. So if you take a look at the third paragraph, they point out that there are some who have fun by actually, some Sephardic Jews actually hit each other with scallions. Believe it or not, it sounds like a very odd kind of practice during the singing of Dayenu. Why would anyone hit each other, even playfully, with scallions while singing a song? What could that possibly represent? Why would Persian and Afghani Jews do such a strange thing?
Well, you've given the answer.
What? Did they explain it?
Yep.
Yeah.
They did.
All right. Okay, right? They say that, that the Jews in the desert had begged. They said, wait, enough of this man, enough of this miracle bread that fell from the heavens in the desert. Instead, they longed for the onions, the leeks, and the garlic. And it represents that. Of course, scallions are bitter, right? They're an unpleasant food. So scallions are, or even some who eat scallions for maror, right? Anyone, right? Either maror or karpas also, right? You have that. Some people do that. So that could also, it might be representative of the bitter enslavement also, right? Karpas, we take a vegetable and we dip it in the salt water. So either it's a spring vegetable, represents freedom, or it's dipped in the salt water because it represents the servitude, the slavery of the Jewish people during the Exodus or prior to the Exodus. So it's possible that the scallion is also representative of that which is bitter, and it recalls sort of the, on the one hand, the slavery and the suffering of the Jewish community, and then yet God's miracles, that despite all that suffering, he came and redeemed us, and that's what we're singing about during Dayenu. So that's some of the more fun or the symbolism that in some families at least accompanies the singing of this spirited song. But I really wanted to spend some time looking at this. And so before we even analyze this song, let's think a little bit about its structure. Okay, so if I were to ask you, before we even read it through, but those who have some recollection from the Seder, what jumps out at you from the song Dayenu? How would you characterize it? Anything that comes to mind? Feel free to just, what comes to your mind when you sing, when you think about this song?
Being satisfied.
Being satisfied. What do you mean? Great.
That you would have been satisfied with the first miracle, as though that was enough, and then he did other miracles and other miracles and other miracles.
Very good.
You had to be satisfied with what you have.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. That we should never take things for granted, and that if God gives us even one miracle, is worthy of praise to God. Beautiful. Other thoughts?
There's two aspects to it. One is, there's a repetitive phrase.
Huh?
Over and over again.
Very good.
It would have been enough.
Right, Dayenu.
Okay, but the principal part of each paragraph, inches, bit by bit, wanting more and more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. And I would say also goes, runs through the story of the Exodus sort of from beginning to end, right? Yeah. You start early on and then you kind of make your way through.
I mean, if it ran long enough, we would be saying, if you only got me a BMW, it would have been enough.
Right. In other words, we could have updated it for the 21st century, as it were, if you kept on going chronologically. 100%. So let's take a look at some of the Hebrew and the English here together, and then we're going to have to come back and begin to analyze it. Now, there are, if you take a look, there are 15 stanzas in the Song of Dayenu, and we'll suggest a little bit later that that's not a coincidence, that there's a certain symbolism to that number. But there are 15 stanzas, and as we said, each one takes us through one stage of the Exodus, and what it says is, if God had only done X and not also done Y, it would have been sufficient. God had only done this, but not that. And each stanza repeats from the one before. So for example, the first one, Ilu hotzianu mimitzrayim, he had only brought us out of Egypt. Velo asa bahem shvatim, right? You can sing along, right? From the tune, you can sing along with yourself in your head, feel free, right? And he had not carried judgments out against the Egyptians during the time of the Exodus, Dayenu. Right, we would have been satisfied, it would have been enough. And then what we do is we pick up, we repeat the phrase before, because the one that we just celebrated, that we said it would be sufficient, that Dayenu. Ilu asa bahem shvatim, right, had he carried judgments against them, velo asa belohem, and not against their idols, Dayenu, right, and so on and so forth. And if you take a look at the English, the way that this goes, let's just see what the stages are. First, it's carried out judgments against them, then it's carried out against their idols specifically. Right, the Elohim, the gods of the Egyptians. Right, if you jump to page 2, right, what's the next one? Not just smiting against the gods, but also specifically, right, top of the second side, had not smitten
their firstborn.
Okay. Notice, by the way, that there's some right. There's judgments, and then there's judgments against the gods, and there's judgments against the firstborn. They're sort of similar, right? They're not identical, but there's some similarity there. We're going to have to think about that more as we go along. Okay, if he had smitten their firstborn, had not given us their wealth, right? So now we have a little bit of a different element. During which of the 10 plagues did the Jews collect the wealth of Egypt? During darkness. Excellent. Right. 9 out of 10. During the Makkah of Choshech, during darkness, the Jews went around. They looted the Egyptian, that money.
The Mishkadel, that always bothered me.
Right. Well, there's some question about it, but some say that it was... Doesn't sound ethical. Well, some say it was actually in compensation for all the free labor that the Egyptians had gotten from the Jews over the course of all that time.
So in the story of Esther, and when they hang Haman, they never take Haman's possessions, I don't think, when I've read the book.
But Haman didn't enslave them. Haman threatened them with genocide. But it wasn't like there had been some sort of
taking from them for hundreds of years.
Not saying that slavery was appropriate or anything like that, but once one chooses to engage in that, the idea of reparations is actually something with which we're familiar. There were demands on the part of Jews for reparations. There were demands on the part of African Americans for reparations in the aftermath of the Civil War.
Reparations after the Holocaust.
Right, that's how I started with. Yes, absolutely. So this is not a concept that's completely foreign.
What did the firstborn do which caused them?
That's a great question. We don't know if that was specifically because those individuals had sinned. The ethics of the plagues of the 10 plagues is a good topic. That's obviously a different lecture. There is a larger question there. It's not necessarily the case that everything was tit for tat, that a particular population did X, Y, or Z necessarily. But it goes to questions that, by the way, these are questions that are not just for God, these are questions are for us. Questions of collective punishment. Right, during times of warfare and the like, are current questions that are very difficult. These are real, real live issues for armies around the world, for the American army, for the Israeli armies, for all sorts of different, these are the questions during when times are very difficult in times of war. What's the right balance between, right, or when someone is subjugating a population this way, what's the correct balance? And those are hard questions.
Something I had read led me to believe that the slaying of the firstborn mm-hmm. was not confined to human beings, mm-hmm. but was also confined or extended to
right.
to animals also.
Well, there were definitely plagues that afflicted the animals,
well,
the Egyptians.
This one in
right,
particular.
But I'm saying,
you know, and through the generations. So it would extend.
Through the generations?
A firstborn of a firstborn.
What does that mean?
I never heard that.
Well, no, you're talking about the slaying of the firstborn.
No.
You only get...
No. It was only then.
Only one generation?
Yeah.
I don't remember reading that.
No, that's not... What would that even...
Well...
There's no indication that the plagues continued to afflict the Egyptians after that time.
We have...
Best of my knowledge.
I mean, we have in law, which was overturned by our U.S. Constitution, mm-hmm. the idea of corruption of blood, mm-hmm. which means that the descendants are punished mm-hmm. for the sins of their parents.
That too is a topic. There's some tension in the Jewish tradition about this question. There's one verse that says very explicitly we do not punish children for the sins of their parents. There's another verse that indicates that we might. So there's a large literature on this subject. There's a verse in Jeremiah about it. This is Yirmiyahu. It's that too is an important topic, but we can only do one thing per class. But we have plenty of material for future classes, thank God. That's a Dayenu, right? So gotta know.
Just want you to know I'm paying attention.
Okay, well I didn't doubt that for a moment, from the moment that you walked in through the doors. So given us their wealth, if you keep on going, then you have splitting the sea. Right? I'm now just more than halfway down the second side. If he had split the sea for us and taken us through dry land, right? So now we have, just like before, we had judgments against the Egyptians generally, judgments against the Egyptian gods, judgments against the Egyptian firstborn. So too here we have a number of nuances, of tweaking within the punishments that were wrought upon the Egyptians surrounding the Red Sea, or the miracles of the Red Sea in general. So if he had split the sea for us and taken us through the dry land, right? Now I'm going, flipping over to side three, right? If he had taken us in the dry land and not drowned our oppressors in it, see again, there's a cluster. One of the things that we'll have to think through together is why are there clusters in Dayenu? It's not just a pure chronological list of 15 disparate or discrete events that took place during the Exodus, during Yetziat Mitzrayim. Instead, it is, I think, a list of subjects, each of which has 2, 3, 4 different elements that are chosen out for whatever reason. Most of Dayenu, not all of it, but most of Dayenu goes in that way. So that's what you have here. Then you have, had he not supplied our needs in the desert for 40 years? We just talked about, right, that connects back to the complaints of the Jews and the man that fell for 40 years and how they said, if only we could go back to Egypt. Right? Of course, that was an imagined surplus of food in Egypt rather than a reality as they were enslaved. Had he not fed us the manna, again, fed us for 40 years, and then more specifically, the miracle bread, as it were, or whatever exactly the manna was. We don't think it was really quite bread, but the coriander or whatever it was that fell down from the heavens. Okay, then we come to Shabbat. It always struck me that Shabbat is pretty much the only one of the 613 commandments for which we thank God, and we thank Him before we even come to thank God for giving us the Torah at Mount Sinai. Which is very interesting, because most of the commandments, we assume, became enforced and became required at the time that we received the Torah as a people at Sinai. And yet, Shabbat here, and the truth is in the Torah itself, precedes the giving of the Torah. Remember, with regards to the man, the Shabbat is connected to the man. What happened? God told the Jewish people in Exodus chapter 16, Shemot Perek Tet Zayin, He says to them that I'm going to send manna raining down from the heavens 6 days a week. Shabbat, nothing will fall. And what's going to happen instead? How are the Jews going to... Right? On? Right. Double portion on Friday. Right? Go out and take. And the Jews don't listen. right? That's a long-standing tradition as well, right? We're a stiff-necked people for quite some time. It's not new, right? We've been doing that for thousands of years. No worries. And so the command of Shabbat, and God even says to the Jewish people, do not exit your homes on Shabbat. There's one of the 39 prohibitions on Shabbat is the idea of not going outside of a certain domain. We build an eruv around Jewish communities for exactly this reason, in order to encompass so that people can carry within those precincts, otherwise it would be impermissible. So this idea of not going or exiting or going too far, and certain laws of Shabbat precede Sinai, and it's very interesting that that's reflected in this song. I have a whole, if we have time, I'll mention a word about that, but that's also noteworthy, I think, when we sing through Dayenu. We now come to the last side. Had God not given us the Shabbat, if he had given us the Shabbat, rather, and had not brought us before Sinai, so what's interesting here is the song of Dayenu begins with the events within Egypt and the Exodus proper, but what does it do? It extends beyond that, right? You see, time-wise, chronologically, temporally speaking, it extends beyond the events in Yemitzrayim, in Egypt per se.
Why did it establish the Shabbat before the events at Sinai?
So I was saying, that's what I was saying before, that in the Torah itself, the Jews receive certain mitzvot of Shabbat even before Sinai. Why that is in Chumash is a good question, but it is. I believe, I'll say in a word, that it might... Well, you have an idea.
Go ahead, Ellen. To me, it makes sense. If without Shabbat, and before you leave your house, once you are commanded to stay and rest, that's when you can begin to ponder and study and read the Torah. Mm-hmm. So Shabbat must come first.
Mm-hmm. But the mandate about Shabbat, comes from Sinai. Mm-hmm. So we're saying it also comes...
Well, it's reiterated at Sinai and reinforced at Sinai, but along with just a handful of other mitzvot, it precedes Sinai as well. There are a couple of these. I'll give you an example. The sciatic nerve. Familiar with the prohibition against eating? The sciatic nerve, the gid hanasheh. Okay, so that's something that it's already commanded. It's actually interesting. What it actually says in the Torah is that therefore the Jews did not eat. It's not quite formulated as a commandment, but that appears already in the Torah itself in context of Jacob's wrestling match with the angel. That's one. The commandment for humanity to procreate, to do what we can to make sure that there will be a next generation within the world, that's already commanded in Parshat Bereishit. That's already in the beginning of Genesis, in the first chapter. So we do have the mitzvah of circumcision is another. So we have a handful and a few others. So the mitzvah of declaring the new month is given to the Jews in the beginning of the 12th chapter of Shemot of Exodus. So we have a handful, but each one needs to be explained on its own. Why was this mitzvah given before Sinai? What makes it different? Is it universal? Does it apply to all of humanity? And so it didn't wait till Sinai? Or was there something else that was different? My theory about Shabbat is that we think of Shabbat as first and foremost a series of commandments. There's an obligation to observe Shabbat. Indeed, there is an obligation in the Jewish tradition to observe Shabbat, but I believe there's a lot of evidence as well that Shabbat is a gift. Shabbat is a gift. And it's a sign of the loving relationship between God and His people. And therefore, God went out of His way to give it to us even earlier than that. Sinai is the time when the Jews received the 613 commandments, the 10 commandments, and then the 613 as a whole. But Shabbat exceeds that. It is both a commandment as well as a gift, a present, a sign of God's loving relationship with the Jewish people. And that, I think, is a major reason that it already precedes Sinai, and that, I think, is beautifully reflected in its having been separated out in the song.
I was going to say, maybe this is not a reason to love Shabbat, but I sat for a week for my father when he passed, and we had people coming and going. We didn't restrict it during the day, and by the time 2 o'clock came on Friday, mm-hmm. and they could no longer come because it was Shabbat, mm-hmm. I understood again how fabulous Shabbat was. I had quiet peace. I went in right before mm-hmm, I was mm-hmm. getting ready in the kitchen. I went and planted something in the ground. I looked up and said, thank you, God, for Shabbat, mm-hmm, giving mm-hmm. me rest. so that I could take on the people Saturday night when they came. Right. A time to be spiritual and think.
Yeah.
And thank God for what he had.
That's very beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Very meaningful. Absolutely. Okay, so we have Shabbat, we have Sinai, and then again we have the coupling or the seeming repetition here. What does it say? It says, if he had brought us before Sinai, for Mount Sinai, and had not given us the Torah. Now, there too, that's very subtle. That kind of reminds me of judgments against the Egyptians, judgments against their gods, judgments against the firstborn. Or he split the sea, he allowed the Jews to walk through the dry land in the sea, and he drowned the enemies of the Jews within that same sea. Right? You see what's happening? Even the idea of Shabbat going with the man. Right, you have the man, you have feeding us in the desert for 40 years, and Shabbat, which went along, which is initially presented to the Jewish people in context of the manna. And here also you have, he brought us to Mount Sinai, right? He brought us to Mount Sinai, and he gave us the Torah. So again, what you have here in Dayenu, I think, is a series of couplings, right? It's or groupings that for which we thank God, and within each grouping we find nuance, we find a different detail, and a couple of different ones, whether it be about the miracles that were wrought by God against the Egyptians, the plagues, whether it be about the splitting of the Red Sea, whether it be about Jews' food, because of course that has to occupy a major place in any song of Jewish Thanksgiving, whether it be in terms of the giving of the Torah, each one is a grouping with different nuances and strands that are sort of unraveled and for which we give thanks to God. And we then come to the end and we say, had he given the Torah and not brought us into the land of Israel, had he brought us into the land of Israel and not built for us the holy temple, Dayenu, it would have been enough. And that concludes the song. After the song, I should add that there is another paragraph. If you look at the Haggadah, take a look this year in a few weeks' time, and you sing Dayenu, you'll see whatever Haggadah you use, if you use the traditional Maxwell House or whatever, what have you. But all of the Haggadot that we have say, beyond that, they say, how grateful we are, Alacha Kama V'chama, just how grateful we are for all the kindnesses that God has performed on behalf of us. We then list the 15 categories. We go through them yet again. And we thank God for having given us the temple to atone for all of our sins. And we end with all of this.
Can you give us a little historical context? The Haggadah was originally part of the Siddur.
Great question. Not exactly, no. There's a lot of literature about the history of the Haggadah as we have it today. The core of the Haggadah is preserved in the Mishnah. So when the Mishnah is compiled as a written document in roughly the year 200 of the Common Era, not the entirety of today's Haggadah, but many of the key elements already appear in the Mishnah.
Is Dayenu there?
Dayenu is not there. Dayenu is very interesting. Scholars generally assume that Dayenu is relatively ancient, and yet the earliest Haggadah in which Dayenu appears is in the 10th century. So we have written, and then from then in pretty much every Haggadah, to the best of my knowledge. So Dayenu definitely has been in writing in the Jewish tradition for roughly 1,100 years, to give some context.
And it's not in the Mishnah.
Not in the Mishnah. There's a debate as to where exactly it comes from and why it was written. There's actually one view that maintains that Dayenu, it's a very interesting suggestion, was essentially even written not just as a standalone song, but as a response to a critique of the Jewish community by early Christians. It's a very interesting thesis. There's a scholar who's done some very, very interesting work in this regard. And he wrote a book. I'm forgetting his last name. His first name is Yuval, and I'm losing his last name for a moment, so it'll come to me. And what he does is essentially he proposes, makes the argument that we know that there's a Christian document or sermon that was published by someone by the name of Melito of Sardis. Melito of Sardis, which is a small European island. And Melito was a believing early Christian. Christian. And he wrote, like many of the early Christians, he did not necessarily have kind things to say about the Jewish community. And they were intentionally, at that time, they were still trying to separate themselves from the Jewish community, which took some time for that to happen. It really started in earnest with Paul, but then it took some time for that to really, for that process to complete itself. So Melito writes this scathing attack on the Jews, and essentially the thrust of this song, of this prayer, is that the Jews are unfaithful and that we are ungrateful. We are ungrateful to God for all of his kindnesses that he performed on behalf of the Jewish community, and the proof to the pudding is that we've rejected the Christian Messiah, and therefore the Jews are ungrateful. Now, at this time, it was very common then, and then especially later through the Middle Ages, what we know that there's a literature called the polemical literature. And there are scholars who study this. And it's very interesting, because at these times there were many, many debates, some of them more mild, and some of them quite active and quite loud in public, between Jews and Christians around this time. There were many disagreements about what specific verses meant. There might be a verse that the Christians read as a reference to the Messiah's second coming, and the Jews would say, nonsense, that's not what the verse means. It actually means something completely different. So in 170 of the Common Era, roughly, Melito of Sardis publishes a sermon in which she accuses the Jews of ungratefulness. And not only that, but a number of the phrases that appear in Dianu appear in his sermon. It's very striking. He talks about the Jews were ungrateful. They were given the temple. They were brought to Israel. They were given all these gifts. And they've just thrown them back in God's face. After all, they've rejected his Messiah from the Christian perspective. And Jews, presumably, did not take very kindly to this. So there are suggestions that Dayenu, which we don't know who the author was. It's anonymous to us. It's unknown that Dayenu was written as a Jewish response to the claim of ungratefulness. You think that we are ungrateful? Quite the opposite. The entire thrust of our tradition is to be grateful to God for the many kindnesses that he performed on our behalf. And I can prove it to you, because look at each of these ones would have been worthy of praise. By the way, that's what Dayenu means. Not that it would have been enough for God to do it. Usually people think that Dayenu means it would have been enough for God to do this. That's not true. If God had split the Red Sea, but not allowed us to pass through safely, right? Right, thanks, but no thanks. If God would have allowed us to cross safely and allowed the Egyptians, who were coming at us with chariots and with weapons of war, who were about to smite us down, what good would it have been? So we're not saying that each one would have been, no problem, that's more than enough, you can stop right there, God. That's not rational. Rather, it's very clear from the continuation, from the conclusion that I had mentioned, where we say to God, what we're saying is, each one would have been deserving for thanksgiving, for praise in its own right. Right? Thanksgiving, although it's not a Jewish holiday, has some very deep Jewish themes that run throughout it. Actually, there's a whole other class on Thanksgiving for a different time of year, but it's just interesting. There's a blessing. It used to be a sacrifice, and now there's a blessing that one recites after escaping from a dangerous circumstance. And the early Christians who came on the Mayflower, specifically, actually had with them, there's a gentleman by the name of John Bradford, he had with him a Bible, it was a Christian Bible, which had been annotated by a 17th century Christian thinker, maybe already 16th century Christian thinker, and at the bottom there are many notes. And this Christian thinker happened, Ainsford was his name, he wrote this commentary, and he actually copied Maimonides' codification of the obligation to give thanksgiving when someone survives during a time of danger. There's such an experience. It was due to this citation of Maimonides' law regarding the obligation to give thanksgiving that the early Christians chose to establish thanksgiving. They said psalms. They said, and this Bradford, who was a pastor who came on the Mayflower, he got off and he cited Maimonides explicitly in calling on the Christians of that time to give thanksgiving. So not only is thanksgiving a deeply Jewish theme, we say modim in our prayers, we give thanksgiving to God, but even the earliest establishment of thanksgiving was based on a passage from Maimonides, which in turn was taken from the Talmud, and that was actually the initial impetus for the early Christians to establish Thanksgiving. So when I say that Thanksgiving is a very Jewish idea, right, the earliest roots of Thanksgiving as we have them go back to none other than Maimonides himself.
What? The controversy about whether Jews can celebrate Thanksgiving.
You're right. And so, right, and so, I mean, I feel very strongly that not only is it permissible, but it's important for Jews to celebrate Thanksgiving. You're right. There was a question, first of all, whether or not turkey is a kosher meat. Or fowl or is turkey. That has been resolved in the positive. Nothing to worry about there generally, but nothing, in my opinion, is nothing to worry about there at all. But that was one discussion. The other one was it's a non-Jewish holiday, so is it considered to be traditional or appropriate for the Jewish community to take it on? There certainly were those who said that it's prohibited or it's not appropriate. My own teachers feel very strongly, and I feel very strongly, that it is a very important thing to give recognition, and that although it's true that the holiday was not technically established by Jews and even was established by Christians, members of a different faith community, I believe that the themes are quite universal and quite Jewish as well. So
I think it's important. And it's important to to be okay with being in the diaspora, but I think it's family.
I agree, but I don't think that therefore a Jew is obligated to celebrate Christmas or something like that.
Family and thankfulness.
Right. Yeah,
which I think family is being together.
Sure, profoundly Jewish experiences.
This, I can understand why children make fun of this and laugh.
Yeah.
Because they have not accrued wisdom of years and gratefulness completely. And this follows a person's life. I mean, I'm not saying it probably right, but if you had done this for me, it would have been enough. If I had healthy children, thank you, God. But I had grandchildren.
You need to live a lifetime in order to really
appreciate that. And that's why you can let them laugh, because they haven't gained wisdom yet and insight into life and how appreciative that they've turned 10, that they've turned 20, 30, 40, 50. Yeah. It's only when they get to be 50, your children, you'll see how they...
You know what? It sounds silly, but
I may not be there yet.
What?
No, he's
not. I'm clearly not. I'm clearly not.
We've been there with
you. You know what? I somehow feel
how old now your baby.
She's gonna be four. Not that.
God,
in September. We got some time.
Please just repeat what Melito.
Melito of Sardis.
How do you spell Melito?
M-E-L-I-T-O.
Okay.
And Sardis is spelled S-A-R-Z-I-S.
I know.
Yeah. So
that's my opinion of it.
Well said. Well said. Okay, so having read through Dayenu and gotten some sense as to it, I wanted to share a couple of additional thoughts that have been on my mind as to what this song represents. So first of all, I just want to talk a little bit about the symbolism of number 15, which I had mentioned earlier. There are 15 sections or praises that we give God. Why is that? Is that a significant number in the Jewish tradition? So the answer is clearly yes. Anyone, any ideas offhand where the number 15 comes up in the Jewish tradition? It might not be widely known, but perhaps someone has an idea.
Yud Hey.
Yud Hey, good. Yud and then a Hey is what? Right, is one of the names of God. Right? So first of all, okay, this in Jewish numerology, in Gematria, it adds up to the name of God, and that's not just an idea that we suggested here today. There was a great Spaniard, a great medieval scholar by the name of Rabbeinu Yom Tov. His last name was Asaveli, or Ashbeli in Hebrew. He was known colloquially as the Ritva. The Ritva is one of the great Spanish medieval scholars, and he says exactly this. Very good. So he comes along and says, this first of all corresponds to the name of God, and it's an allusion to the idea that we're grateful, of course, to God, and so we capture God's essence, his name, in the actual numerology of this song. So that's a beautiful suggestion, and that's certainly one of the ideas that's offered by the classical commentators. Very good. Additionally, in the temple, there were 15 steps that ascended essentially into the, not the innermost sanctum, but as you entered into the temple, into the Azara, from the courtyard, one part of the courtyard to another, there were 15 steps, intentionally 15, and the Levites used to stand on each of those steps in ascending order as they would sing the songs during the sacrificial service. The Levites were the ones who had the good voices and or played the instruments, right? So they were... Right, gets, if you don't know who's going to be the Chazan, try to call upon a Levite, and hopefully, hopefully it'll go well. It's a good shot. Okay, so there you have it. And so that was actually, there were 15 steps, and those 15 steps themselves, according to tradition, correspond as well to the 15 songs of Psalms. There's a whole section. Part of it we say, for example, when we bench during Birchat HaMazon, after the grace after meals, we say, right? It starts Shir HaMa'alot, a song of ascent, going up the stairs, as it were. According to there are 15 consecutive chapters toward the end of Psalms that contain the phraseology of Shir HaMa'alot, and so it's from 120 to 134. Those 15, right? Because it's 15 chapters, and according to tradition, the 15 chapters are corresponding to the 15 steps. They're steps of ascent. The Levites would sing a different song of Shir HaMa'alot, or praise to God, on each of the 15 steps going up to the temple. And then there's an additional practice that we have nowadays that corresponds to this as well. Some say that if you count, we have 15 blessings in the morning of Thanksgiving. Not coincidentally, right? When we say, Baruch Atah Hashem, blessed be you, O God, who gave us all sorts of kindnesses, all sorts of gifts. And those are traditionally recited in the synagogue at the beginning of the prayer services. 15 steps of song corresponding to 15 psalms of thanksgiving, which are then captured in 15 blessings of thanksgiving that are recited on a daily basis by the Jewish community. And, by the way, these are not my ideas. The commentaries, just like the Ritva, he and other commentaries point out all the allusions that I'm sharing with you today. And so, again, all this comes together to reinforce this idea that 15 is considered to be, perhaps corresponding to the name of God himself, is considered to be a powerful sign of thanksgiving, a motif of thanksgiving in the Jewish tradition.
I think there are also 15 at the beginning of the Haggadah.
15. Oh, that's interesting. So depends how you count it.
Like, okay, that's true.
Right? If you split up, traditionally it's viewed as 14, which is why I leave it out. But there are some Haggadot where, for whatever reason, Shulchan Orech is presented as
Shulchan.
Period, Orech. You have to have a table and you have to set it. You know, it's kind of like Dayanu. If you have a table but you don't set the table with food, you're not going to get anything. If you have food but you don't have a table on which to set it, right, you're not going to get anywhere either, right? Again, Jews and food. So maybe that, and again, the Seder is all about giving thanksgiving to God. Ultimately, that really is what its essence is, so that would fit in nicely as well. Very good.
When your son, you have a boy, don't you?
Yeah, yes. My oldest
when
is a boy.
He makes his own home and leaves you. I know you can't even picture that yet.
No, I can actually.
Can you?
Oh no, he's ready to go out of the house already. I promise I didn't mean it that way. There are some days like that too.
Well, he invited us one night for, I guess, Rosh Hashanah or whatever.
Okay.
And we get to the apartment. He's there. We're so proud of him. We're so thrilled to be there.
Right.
And he's got all the food in the refrigerator. Nothing, everything is wrapped up.
Yeah.
And nothing out.
Classic. So
he's got all of that, but he didn't set the table.
He didn't set the table. There you go.
That's where mother comes in.
I was going to say, that's your boy. Yeah, no. That's why I don't. I don't claim to be good at this stuff. Oh, I can picture it. I'm good. I'm there.
How old is he?
He's only 10, but...
Oh, 10. He's almost bar mitzvah.
He's going to be bar mitzvah. Yeah. Maybe I feel older than I look. I don't know. But
He's certainly not even close.
Certainly not even close. Yeah, we have...
I was going to give this to you, of course.
Oh, did you think it was 1 o'clock?
I forgot.
Oh, that's okay.
I didn't email you because I thought you knew.
No problem. Come on over. Come join us. It's okay. Not a problem. So this is the number 15. We're talking about Dayenu. So that's the number 15. Now, I think that the number 15 is not only important as a number, but because it focuses us in on what I want to suggest is part of the essence of this song. When I think of this song, if you would ask me, in addition to everything that everyone mentions, there's just one word that's overwhelming, which is the repetition. You know, think about, especially when we sing it, even if you would look at the musical notes, right? That's repetition enough, right? Die, die, enu. Now think about what we do. Die, die, enu. Die, die, enu. Die, enu, die, enu. Die, enu. Let me do it again, right?
Love it.
If you look at the musical notes, it's interesting that I believe that they capture, in a sense, the essence of the song. Because it is a song that is all about saying the same thing again and again and again in very slightly nuanced different ways. And it's very interesting, right? If you look around at your home, different homes have different practices. Some homes sing the whole Dayenu refrain every single time. You know what I'm talking about? Like you can do that 15 times like that again and again and again. And when I was growing up, it just got too much. So we instituted a different policy. We sang it once at the beginning and once at the end. And we didn't sing the whole elaborate thing. It wasn't even a rule that anyone made. It's just something that happened. And I think the reason that it happened is because it felt a little bit repetitious, right? Like at a certain point, like, okay, we got the whole idea, Dayenu, like we're good, we're done too, like we've said this already. And we even pointed out and noticed,
everybody's hungry,
right? And it's right. Also late in the Haggadah, so you're right. Ready for
it's
the meal,
long service.
That's exactly right.
And we're losing the children.
That's it. And then you have to be educationally aware when we design the, you know, the Haggadah.
I used to be, you know, under the table when my grandparents were in South Street. Okay. I finally, it was almost 12 o'clock, right. And they're Orthodox, and I'm like under the table playing. They allowed me to do that. Maybe I was six, you know.
Right. And then they called you up when it was time, right?
Right.
So that's the
and
same thing.
And they knew I was there.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing. Now, this idea of the repetition, I think, is actually all over Dayenu. I don't think it's a coincidence. Remember, we noticed that it's not just 15 separate praises, but they're really a couple of four or five clusters of praises, and each one has its own nuances. I think that's this as well. It's really a rep. Each one, almost all the praises of Dayenu are repeated in slightly different ways. So even when we say, if it weren't for this, it would have been for that, right? If God had only done X and not done Y, we'd still be able to give thanksgiving. I think that that's part of it as well. There's a lot about the language that's repetitious. And there's actually if you study poetry, if you study literature, there are poetic terms that actually capture these kinds of methodologies. So for example, if the beginning of a word is repeated in each stanza, like you have this in poetry or in literature sometimes, that's called anaphora.
What is it?
Anaphora.
Anaphora
is called A-N-A-P-H-O-R-A. Anaphora. So you have, if Shakespeare does it with his sonnet, so then that's called anaphora, right? And that's the repetition in the beginning. If you have repetition at the end, that's called something else. That's called epistrophe. Okay, epi is, right, is the end, and it's the repetition of that which is at the end. Oh, wow, we have two 1 o'clock. Okay, we started at 12. We're almost toward the end, but we're more than happy to have you. And I have a handout for you. Pass that down, and you can also feel free to grab some food. Dayenu does both. Notice, it has anaphora. And it has epistrophe. It's really quite remarkable. You know, we think of Dayenu as a song, but there's a literary genius to this song, which I think is quite striking.
Also a little bit of alliteration.
What?
There's
go ahead.
Some alliteration.
Where's the alliteration? Go ahead.
In the repetition of the words.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know if it would technically fall under the category of alliteration, because alliteration typically is with different words that share similar sound. So I don't know if it technically... What time? Okay. So I don't know if it technically falls under the category of alliteration, but it would be pretty similar. The repetition is there as well. It's actually, I think it's intentional. And I want to share with you a phrase from a scholar of the Haggadah. His name is Joseph Tabori. Joseph Tabori is a historian and scholar who lives in Israel. His brother was one of my teachers when I studied in Israel. So Rav Tabori, Binyamin Tabori, his brother Yosef Tabori, he said the following about the Haggadah. He said something interesting. He says, at times, and I think this captures the point, at times the content itself of Dayenu, the content itself is subjugated to the form.
To the form.
The content is subjugated to the form.
I believe that.
What?
I believe that.
I do too. I think it's right.
That's a characteristic of virtually all writing.
Of virtually all writing. Okay. But I think sometimes it's more accented and kind of jumps out at you than other times.
The problem is it's a failing of the writer. Couldn't think of a better way to say it.
Could be. It's either could be a failing or it could be intentional. In other words, it's a legitimate methodology for reinforcing a certain kind of idea. If the motif... To me, it's not a question of right or wrong. It's a question of what's the goal, what's the message, what's the purpose of this particular piece of literature or a song. If the idea is to tell a wide-ranging story, that's one thing. If the idea is to reinforce the idea of repetition, right? Especially, remember, if it's a response, if it's a polemical response to the charge of lack of gratefulness, the point is, we are grateful, we are grateful, we are. You say we're not grateful, not grateful, we're not. We are. Here's why. So I think it's less a question of, it's true that a less talented author can hide behind repetition. That's true. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a less talented person. It might just be that that's the right form because the form reflects the essence. So it's a tricky thing to know.
He conceals his brilliance.
What?
He conceals his brilliance.
Right, or that is his...
With the illusion of weakness.
Right? Okay. So be that as it may, but I think that the brilliance of this song is that it's not so much about the details, but it really is about this idea of the Thanksgiving. And I think that the 15 motif is consistent with that as well, because it's about the number 15. It's about the 15-fold repetitions more so than it is about any specific one. Each one has something to teach us. We said before, Shabbat is there for a reason, and it teaches us something about Shabbat, not just as a command, but as a gift. And each one, we talked about the money that the Jews looted, and so on and so forth. Each detail has something unique to teach us about the song, but ultimately the song is one of kind of repetition of a very similar motif in this, and ultimately this same idea. And I think that ultimately that really is what Dayenu is all about. Dayenu is the fundamental statement that as Jewish people, our essence, who we are, is to say Dayenu. And what I think that means is as follows. Dayenu teaches us that every nuance and every detail that we have in our lives, that we stop and we smell the roses. And I think that that's a very powerful idea, and it's not one that's common in our society. In our society, there are a lot of things that happen that we take for granted, and it's very challenging in our fast-paced world in which we live sometimes to stop and to express appreciation for the gifts that we are given. But I think Dayenu is ultimately about this message. Dayenu is about stopping and saying at every conceivable juncture and saying, wow, this is a gift. And you're sitting there at the Seder with their family. This family member is a gift. This family member is another gift. Every single one. This song that we sing, this ritual that we have, you know, this accomplishment of my grandchild or what have you, every single one of these is a special gift. And Dayenu is about the ability to repeat that phrase almost endlessly upon each and every one of the gifts that we are given and to be able to find the nuances and the details within that. So I think it's a very powerful Jewish idea, and I think it's a very moving Jewish message. And that indeed is my blessing to all of us this year, as we join with our families at the Seder, table, may we find not just the larger blessings, but every single individual blessing, and may we share that appreciation with our families, and hopefully in doing so, and in expressing our gratitude, we should have many more blessings, and much more to be grateful for, so that we can also say Dayenu, not just at the Seder, but throughout the year to come. So that's what I wanted to share today. I thank everyone as always for coming. If you see our regulars, feel free to send them back our way. Next time is not for 2 months. It's May 17, we said,
yes.
Right? Wednesday, May 17 at noon, not 1 o'clock, at noon. And we look forward to seeing everyone who was able to make it back. And I hope everyone feels well. You should have a smooth recovery. And everyone have a wonderful Passover and a wonderful Seder. And look forward to continuing soon.